In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Yeah.
Let's all go to the lobby.
It is time to do the movie thing, which we do every Monday afternoon with our friend Alan Adams from The Main Edge. Hello there, Alan.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. How's your Monday?
So far, so good.
And the weekend, was that acceptable?
It was fine. It was, relatively quiet. Spent the majority of the time here at home, which, you know, vastly different than all the other weekends for the past however long, you know.
let's mix it up, and this time we'll stay home again.
Yeah, sometimes we go left when we go on our dog walk instead of right.
Sometimes we just come in through the front door like we're guests.
Right? We're doing fine, but you know, it's nice to sort of see the light that illuminates the light at the end of the tunnel. Like, I don't think we're quite there, but do you know what I mean?
I do.
Like the news coming out today is just like, okay. Like, you just feel things sort of unknotting just a little bit. We've got a long way to go, but
it's nice to have some sense of a possible timeline, though.
Sure, and it's nice to look around and be like, oh, so the government still more or less works, so that's nice.
More or less, yeah.
You know, like things seem to be playing out the way they're supposed to right now.
Yeah,
so, like, all right, well, let's cross our fingers.
There you go. Well, you did see a plethora of movie-age this weekend, four of them to talk about. Where do we begin?
Let's start with the sports movie in the bunch. We watched this movie called Safety. It's a Disney original. It's streaming on Disney Plus. I vaguely remembered this story from back in the day. It's based on a true story of a Clemson football player by the name of Ray McElrathby, who wound up taking in his little brother because his mother had to go into a treatment program for substance abuse. Very, very much a feel-good kind of story. It's a Disney movie, so I imagine any grittier aspects of the story have been thoroughly sanded down. Look, man, I'm a sucker for an inspirational sports movie. Like, I don't care what the sport is. I don't care what the story is. Like, give me athletes overcoming obstacles and coming together as a team in the course of that overcoming. Like, I'm in. And this movie very much delivers on that front. So Ray McElrathby, played by Jay Reeves, young guy from Atlanta who's achieved his dream. He's got a scholarship to play football for Clemson. And he's taken on a lot, like, not just football, but he's got a very ambitious course load, and he's really looking forward to putting forth his maximum effort, both on the field and in the classroom. But, again, things at home are tough. Like, his mom is struggling with substance abuse, and a relapse has left her unable to care for Ray's little brother, Famar, a young man named Thaddeus Nixon, this is apparently his feature debut, but he's delightful. She winds up in getting a spot in a 30-day treatment facility. And so Ray is left with the decision, do you let your brother, like, enter into the foster care system until mom gets out, or do you take the boy in yourself? And despite all the rules to the contrary, Ray goes ahead and brings Famar to Clemson to live with him. You know, and he does his best to keep it all together and keep it all secret, but people suspect something's up. His roommate obviously knows, but head coach... Tommy Bowden was the coach of Clemson at that point. So Tommy Bowden is played by Matthew Glaive, and Ray's position coach, Brad Simmons, played by James Dale. They're both very unimpressed with what seems to be a lack of focus, and he's also having trouble with the young lady, Casey, Corinne Fox. She's relatively new to the screen, but she is perhaps known for her famous father, Jamie Fox. She's the fellow student that he's kind of found a spark, but he's scared to share the secret. Then we reach the end of the 30-day mark, and then it you know, circumstances necessitate that maybe Famar needs a place to stay for even longer. And so Ray's kind of at a crossroads. Like, how far is he willing to go, and what is he willing to sacrifice to do what's best for his brother? And who, if anyone, is going to help him? Like, I'm gonna avoid spoilers here, but, I mean, the reality is, like, even if you don't already know this story, like, you can pretty much work out how it goes. Like, I mean, it's Disney, for God's sake. Like, even the tragic aspects are going to be pretty glossy. And the long and storied history of inspirational sports movies tells you everything you need to know regarding the narrative beats that you're going to hit. But that's kind of okay. Like, the predictability is part of the package when it comes to this sort of movie. Like I don't tune into an inspirational sports movie on a Disney streaming service because I expect to be surprised by some bleak turn. Like, this is like, I'm here to feel good, and Disney knows that. So they're going to connect all the dots needed to take us on the journey that moves us in the way we expect to be moved and ends the way we expect it to end. So in that respect, it's a pretty solid movie. Like, I mean, it's pretty workmanlike, you know, but I will say the execution of the football action is actually pretty good. Now, this is a movie with football in it rather than a football movie. So there's not as much football, and frankly, I kind of expected to see a little bit more, but what we do see is pretty good. The performances are fine. Reeves does a nice job as Ray. Like, he looks the part, and, you know, is largely playing it straight, which gives room for the kid who, again, like I said, is very charming, to get some laughs as precocious kid doing precocious kid things. They have a very nice brotherly dynamic, and frankly, their relationship is probably the most effective aspect of the movie. Everyone else is fine. Like, it all plays out the way you more or less expect. Like, they hit their marks, they say their lines, they check all the inspirational movie boxes. You've got the troubled parent and the comic relief roommate, the hard-ass coach, and then you have the other hard-ass but secretly sensitive and supportive coach. You know, you've got your on- and off-field rival, which is funny, who's actually played by a guy who actually played in the NFL, this guy Miles Burris, who played for a year or two with the Raiders before retiring and moving on to Hollywood. But yeah, it's not a life-changing movie, but it's affirmational and inspirational, and, you know, ultimately, sometimes it doesn't really matter if you know your buttons are being pushed, as long as they're being pushed well, and this movie pushes them well enough.
All right, that's the story on safety. What's up next?
Well, let's do this one, because we only had one real stinker this weekend. So it's a movie called The Stand-In. It's Hollywood has this long history of actors playing multiple roles in the same film. Like, you know, sometimes it's like mining the possibilities of people resembling one another, like mistaken identities or swaps or that kind of thing. And other times it's just because Eddie Murphy or Adam Sandler wants a wider runway to do whatever goofy stuff they want to do. So The Stand-In is the sort of latest entry into this particular genre. And this time we've got Drew Barrymore playing two different roles. It's a story about this famous actress and her stand-in. Ostensibly, it's an effort to sort of document the deleterious impact of fame on people, you know, doing so by way of yet another riff on The Prince of the Pauper. Like, that's basically what we're doing here. But unfortunately, this film really struggles to decide the tone it wants to strike. Like, it moves from comedy to drama and back again, like, constantly, and like almost always without warning. So you have this almost narrative whiplash when it comes to watching it. And again, Drew Barrymore's going for it. Like, this is not her fault. She gives it her all. But the lack of consistency just kind of leaves you wondering what the point was. And granted, like, if you're looking to make a movie that can't figure out if it's Bowfinger or Single White Female, then great, mission accomplished. I can't imagine that's what you're trying to do. So the basic gist is Barrymore plays Candy Black, who is a sort of pratfalling physical comedy star who has an iconic catchphrase, and she's a global phenomenon. She's got a reputation as difficult to work with, and as well as a pretty significant substance abuse problem, but she keeps getting hired because her terrible movies are massive box office hits, thanks to a willingness to fall down and say catchphrases. Now, Barrymore also plays Paula, who is the sort of stand-in. She's meek and eager to please, just happy to be part of show business, even as she's usually forced to be the mediator between a drug-addled, angry Candy and whoever she happens to be angry at the moment. But it all starts to crumble when Candy has a particularly bad meltdown on set, that results in significant injury to one of her co-stars, played by Ellie Kemper. This leads to a complete sort of abandonment of the business entirely, you know, which sort of upsets Paula because her resemblance to Candy seems to be pretty much her only marketable skill. We jump forward 5 years in time. Candy's in her crumbling mansion. Instead of acting, she's become devoted to the craft of Shaker furniture, because this is the kind of movie we're talking about. She's a hermit, although she's established some communication with a fellow woodworking enthusiast via the internet. And then we have some barely explained shenanigans involving taxes, which means that Candy is, for some reason, forced to go to rehab. But instead of going to rehab, she asks her former stand-in and basically says, hey, go in my place. I'll pay you or whatever. And Paula agrees, but only if Candy returns to the business so that Paula can go back to being a stand-in. We have the rehab stint. Paula moves in with Candy. They come to an agreement. Paula basically starts making appearances, doing sort of the big apology tour, hitting the circuit, appearing on talk shows and all that stuff. But it's not enough. Paula insinuates herself into Candy's life, her relationships, and slowly tries to take over Candy's life. She's gotten this taste for fame and does not want to give it back. And so it's up to Candy to wrest back control before it's too late. And that's where we are. This movie wants to be a Hollywood satire. It wants to be a broad comedy. It wants to be an exploration of identity. It is not any of those things, Rich. Sometimes it's light, sometimes it's dark. There's no rhyme or reason as to when or why. Honestly, it's the kind of thing where you almost think if the people involved had picked a lane and stayed in it, this could have been a decent movie. But instead, it's this weird mishmash that veers between like dull and off-putting and kind of nonsensical. And again, you can see the bits where it could have worked. Honestly, you make this movie where Barrymore is basically doing a riff on Sandler because they're buddies. Like, that would work. Maybe you go dark on the stand-in side and lean into the psychodrama of the thing. That could have worked. Instead, we get flashes of both that results in a movie that's really nothing. Like, I don't know. It's just like what's more shallow than surface level? Like, that's the kind of insight that we're getting from this movie. And I can't stress enough, it's not Drew Barrymore's fault. Like, she really goes for it. Like, she's doing her best to sort of differentiate these characters. And, as someone who's kind of been through it, like, she kind of understands this world and the sorts of people in it better than most. But the dialogue and the plotting and all that stuff really gets in the way. Like, frankly, don't blame Drew, blame her agent, because that's clearly whose fault it is that we're here in the first place. And the supporting cast is great, too. Like, Ellie Kemper, I mentioned, but, like, Holland Taylor's in this movie, Andrew Rannells, Michelle Buteau, like, just some really talented people. And all they get to do is basically just polish whatever turds this script has given them. Like, they're game, but there's only so much you could do. So, yeah, it's a comedy that's not funny, it's a thriller without any thrills, and it's a satire with very little to say. Feel free to sit the stand-in out.
All right, so we can only move onward and upward then if we talk with either The Prom or Let Them All Talk. Where are we going?
Let's go to The Prom first. I was only vaguely familiar with this The Prom. My understanding is it was a very popular Broadway musical not so long ago. And we've seen a lot of sort of musicals making that transition from stage to screen in recent years. And it's an interesting process because you never really know if the filmmakers are going to be able to capture the essence of a musical, like the spirit, finding the right ways to convert that sort of nature of a live performance, particularly live musical performance, onto film. It's always a crapshoot. Like, sometimes you get West Side Story, sure, but sometimes you get Cats. And this is one of those movies, and it's funny because it's received a very polarizing response. It's not the sort of movie that you would expect to sort of divide people so thoroughly. But yeah, like, this is a movie that could be deemed closer to the former, the West Side Story, or to the latter, to Cats, depending on who you ask. Like, Ryan Murphy of American Horror Story fame directed. It was adapted to the screen by two of the three writers of the musical. So that's good. And it's this brightly colored and broad and a little dated look at sort of inclusivity and celebrity activism and the like. Now, they've got some really great high-energy performances. The production numbers are delightful, and there are some really catchy songs. Like, it's all in service of what's ultimately intended to be a very sweet story. And it's got a really talented cast, too. It does get a little clunky, and there are some very heavy-handed moments scattered throughout and a few missteps. But it's, by and large, a fun and pretty funny take on, well, the sort of the divide between wanting to help versus actually helping. So you've got this young girl, Emma Nolan, played by this young lady, Jo Ellen Perlman. It's her first movie. Like, she was basically part, like, cast, like, plucked from obscurity from a nationwide search to play this part. She's a 17-year-old girl living in a small town in Indiana. And she is the center of a sort of cultural maelstrom, thanks to the fact that she is A, gay, and B, wants to bring her girlfriend to the prom. The town's parents, particularly PTA President Mrs. Green, played by Kerry Washington, are up in arms at the idea. And despite the advocacy of her principal, Principal Hawkins, played by Keegan-Michael Key, the PTA basically votes to eliminate the prom entirely rather than let someone bring a same-sex date. And that turns her into a bit of a pariah among her peers. At the same time, a new Broadway musical, The Story of Eleanor Roosevelt, has opened to scathing reviews. The stars, including aging diva Dee Dee Allen, Meryl Streep as Eleanor, and the flamboyant stage vet Barry Glickman, played by James Corden as FDR, are left to sort of contemplate their looming obsolescence. They're drinking at the bar at the sort of abandoned after party. The bartender is a former, like, castmate of theirs, who's, you know, between gigs, a guy, his name's Trent, played by Andrew Rannells, who we just mentioned a minute ago. And then we have career chorus girl, the delightfully named Angie Dickinson, played by Nicole Kidman. And so these four, they want to take up a cause, not a big one, a manageable one. And Angie scrolls through Twitter, sees Emma's story trending, and they decide, we're going to go to Indiana and insert themselves into this controversy. Ostensibly, they're there to help, but their real goal is basically to just get more of the spotlight shined on them in a positive manner. But once you know it, Rich, turns out their presence isn't necessarily welcomed by the people of this small Indiana town. They're not really interested in what's being offered up by these visitors. And it's not long before that antipathy starts to build, and the visitors wind up doing more harm than good. Meanwhile, Emma is dealing with conflicted feelings of her own, not to mention those of her girlfriend, who is dealing with some fear and doubts with regard to the very public outing that they're planning. So the visitors connect with Emma and the people close to her, but they continue to get in their own way, with their very own specific ideas about the world, confronted by a place that is different from the one in which they live. Now look, this movie's fun in a lot of ways. Like, like I said, the songs are excellent. There's some really first-rate production numbers. It's a very brash and shiny sort of bauble. But it's got some problematic aspects. Whether you want to talk about the sort of relative neatness of the boxes into which certain people and events are placed. Not going to be any more specific of that because I want to avoid spoilers. And the big one, a lot of people have a problem with the performance of James Corden specifically, due to I'll be honest, I didn't love it. I think my biggest issue was a lot of the performance bases uses flamboyance as affect rather than as a genuine personality trait. Like, I'm not someone who's going to condemn a straight actor for playing a gay character or vice versa, but Corden's take kind of ventures into the cartoonish in spots, and it doesn't really feel earned. I guess that's the big issue that I have with it. Like I'm okay with that sort of over the top camp if you earn it through the genuineness of your portrayal. And it just, I don't know, there's just something jarring about it. That being said, there's some charm to the underlying story. I might argue that a little nuance could go a long way in this story. But look, Ryan Murphy's not interested in nuance. That's not his deal. And so he's not interested, so neither is the prompt. And again, the bigger, bolder moments are the ones that are most effective. You know, and like I said, the cast is stacked. Like, movie musical Meryl is one of my favorite Meryls. Like, she's clearly having a good time here. Andrew Rannells is someone who I'm not super, like he's one of those guys who's been around for a while, and I've seen him in a bunch of stuff. But I'm always, there's always that moment of surprise where I'm like, oh man, this guy's really talented. And then you have Nicole Kidman, who's weirdly underused. Like, there's something just a little bit unsettling about a movie star who's just kind of floating in the background for most of the movie. Kerry Washington does her thing. She's off-putting and shrill to maximum effect. Keegan-Michael Key. Now, like, I've started to see him as sort of a secret weapon almost in movies. Like he's a legitimate triple threat, and you don't necessarily view the guy from Key and Peele as someone who's like that. But like he can sing, he can dance. Like, this is the, you know, this is the first, I mean, this is the second movie in a row that I've seen him in where he does all those things, because he was great in Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey last month as well. Like, he's really great. Pellman, the newcomer, is just, she's lovely. She's got a lovely voice and a lovely presence. I'm very much looking forward to seeing what happens next for her. But look, the movie has a lot going for it, but it has some not insignificant strikes. Like, if you go in with relatively low expectations and don't think too hard about the specifics, you're going to have a good time. You start pulling those threads, though, and it's going to start to unravel. Don't anticipate a standing ovation. You should be fine. And again, as I will end every review of any movie musical, at least it was better than Cats.
All right. We don't have much time left, about a minute and a half. What can you tell us about Let Them All Talk?
It's Steven Soderbergh doing Steven Soderbergh stuff.
Yeah.
Like, it's this wonderful sort of hangout kind of movie. It's currently available on HBO Max. Quasi-indie shot, like this wonderful dramedy with a great cast. Meryl Streep, again, along with Diane Wiest and Candice Bergen. Streep plays a celebrated novelist who's won a literary award, wants to accept it in person, but it's in London. She don't fly. So she basically does a transatlantic crossing on the Queen Mary II and brings her friends, as well as her nephew, played by Lucas Hedges. And that's kind of the deal. Like, it's just, the script is ostensibly by Deborah Eisenberg, but I guess most of the dialogue was improvised. Like, it's very a very Christopher Guest, sort of Larry David style of filming. And it was basically just Soderbergh, like, running around with a camera. Like, he was his own cinematographer and editor, and they actually did a crossing on the Queen Mary II. And filmed while they were on there, and that was that's kind of the deal. It feels a little stunty, but in a very fun Soderbergh way. And that's really all you need to know. Like, you need to know that cast, that filmmaker, and that concept. And like, it's really well worth your time. Like, it's a lot of fun. It's Soderbergh doing Soderbergh stuff. And I'll take that any day of the week.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good to me. Hey, thanks, Al. Appreciate it. As always, have a good couple of days, and we'll visit with you again come Wednesday.
Sounds good to me, man.
Alan Adams of The Main Edge, every Monday and Wednesday on Downtown.